Joe Biden vient tout juste d'annoncer le retrait des troupes américaines d'Afghanistan pour septembre 2021. Mais quelle est sa politique étrangère au Moyen-Orient? Julie-Pierre Nadeau en parle avec trois collègues américains experts de ces questions. Gregory Gause, Trita Parsi et Paul Lenz. Cette discussion est en anglais, mais vous allez voir, elle est absolument incontournable dans le contexte actuel. Vous écoutez le balado de la chaire. Bonjour tout le monde, je m'appelle Frédéric Gagnon, je suis titulaire de la chaire Raoul Dandurand en études stratégiques et diplomatiques de l'Université du Québec à Montréal et vous écoutez le balado de la chaire. C'est un balado qui vous permet d'entendre nos conférences si vous les avez ratées et des capsules d'analyse de l'actualité internationale, de l'actualité politique aux États-Unis et de la culture populaire américaine. Je vous souhaite une bonne écoute.
I want to welcome everyone to this second panel, Biden in the Middle East, a new era for foreign policy. My name is Julie-Pierre Nadeau. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Quebec in Montreal. I'm also a research fellow at the Center for United States Studies at the Raoul Dandurand Chair for Strategic and Diplomatic Studies in Montreal. And it's my pleasure to moderate this panel today. Since the first panel looked at the Middle East perspective and expectations toward the new administration, this panel will look at the flip side. So we'll talk about the American perspective on key issues in the Middle East and discuss President Biden's foreign policy towards the region. We have an hour and 15 minutes ahead of us, which will be divided in a 50-minute roundtable discussion. And on that note, I now want to welcome my three panelists for today. First, Dr. F. Gregory Gause, professor and head of Department of International Affairs at the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. Welcome, Dr. Gause. Second, Dr. Paul Lenz, senior lecturer at the Department of Politics and International Affairs of Northern Arizona University and an associate member of our Center for Middle Eastern and Northern African Studies at the Raoul Dandurand Chair. And finally, Dr. Trita Parsi, author and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. So welcome to you all, and thank you again for accepting our invitation. Before we talk about the details of Biden's foreign policy in the Middle East, let's first assess what he inherited from the past administration. I think Donald Trump was fairly involved in the region. I think it's good to start with maybe a summary of what happened in the past 4 years, and we'll go from there. And also how different President Biden might be from President Trump. So to start this discussion, I will ask you all an individual question, and I'll start with Dr. Gause. I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump had a friendlier approach towards Saudi Arabia and especially towards the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Do you expect the U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia to change under the new administrations, or do you think the Biden administrations will stay on the same path?
Well, it won't be exactly the same path, but it won't be the change that perhaps President Biden indicated on the campaign trail and that many people in the United States, particularly in the human rights community, had hoped for. So I think that the most important thing that the Trump administration did in its 4 years vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia is it got involved in the politics of the ruling family itself, which I think was a big mistake. And I think that President Trump's embrace of Mohammed bin Salman, even before he was crown prince, kind of gave the signal that the United States would not only be willing to accept, but would encourage a power play by the current crown prince to consolidate power within his own hands. This was quite surprising because the person he turfed out as Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, had for two presidential terms, the Bush administration, Bush 43, and the Obama administration been America's favorite Saudi, because Mohammed bin Nayef, as Minister of the Interior, had been America's contact person on counterterrorism issues with Saudi Arabia. And in the post 9/11 period, that was at the top of the American agenda. So the Trump administration and President Trump personally kind of privileging MBS, I think had an impact. It's hard to tell, the internal machinations of the al-Saud family are not an open book, but it certainly identified the Trump administration very clearly with MBS. And I think it encouraged the Crown Prince to think that he could act with a certain amount of impunity on the world stage. I think the things that are going to change under the Biden administration are that the Crown Prince is no longer going to have a privileged channel directly into the White House, right? Under the Trump administration, the Crown Prince had a direct channel to Mr. Kushner, to Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, and thus directly into the White House. And therefore, I think he felt that he didn't have to listen to anything an American Secretary of State or an American Secretary of Defense or an American ambassador would say to him, because he could go over all of their heads directly to the White House. That's not going to happen anymore. But on the other hand, the Biden administration, and I think we saw this in the release of the redacted report on the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the Biden administration believes that it still has to deal with MBS because he is the day-to-day chief executive in Saudi Arabia. And they think that to move ahead on things like Yemen, to move ahead on other issues in the region, they're going to have to find some way to deal with it. And I think that it's something of a change, but it's a change. It's less of a change than many people thought might happen.
So you think it's more of a continuity than change for the next few years?
Yeah, I think it's continuity in the sense that the United States-Saudi relationship is something that predates the Trump administration, and it goes back quite a ways. In my view, it's an important relation to sustain. I think that this gets us beyond the question of the specifics of the Biden administration, and I'll end here unless you want to follow up on it. But to me, the big issue in the region is the collapse of state authority. I mean, we have civil wars raging in Libya, in Syria, in Yemen. We're getting out of one, maybe in Iraq. We might be on the verge of one in Lebanon, a very weak state. In the Palestinian Authority, we have problems of authority there, problems of authority in the authority there, and the split between Hamas and the PA. And it really does seem to me that if you're going to take a longer term view of the Middle East, the United States isn't very good at dealing with non-state actors, but it's pretty good at dealing with state actors. And I think you got to deal with the state actors, and that includes Iran. And it includes a number of countries, it includes Turkey, that have problematic human rights records. And it seems to me that the United States has to be open to dealing with all of them as we go forward. And the Saudis are just another one of those problematic state actors.
Thank you. I think since you've mentioned already the civil wars in Syria and Libya, I'm going to move to Dr. Lenz. As we know, the Syrian and Libyan conflicts have been going on for a few years now. And I was wondering, what are the implications of those conflicts for U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East? And what do you see in the future regarding those conflicts and U.S. involvement?
Thank you, Julie-Pierre, for your question. I want to agree with Dr. Gause. The collapse of state authority is a huge problem for the future of the region. And as we've seen since at least for the last 2 to 3 years, we've seen an increasing influence of Russia within places like Syria and even in Libya. And even China now is moving to try and get involved within the region. So I think one of the biggest implications for the U.S. moving forward is literally trying to balance the power of these external actors within the region and the propping up of certain actors relative to others, whether it's challenging the Assad regime in Syria or the Eastern Mediterranean oil and gas pipeline issue and how that's affecting the Libyan civil war. I think these are going to be the major issues moving forward, is that we're seeing a geopolitical conflict driven by economics, specifically oil and gas issues, trying to balance the increasing influence of Russia in the Middle East. I think this is where the United States can have a major role in the future of the Middle East, but it's going to create much more conflict, I think, in the short term versus the long term.
Following up on what you just said, we have to think back to the Obama administration, but as you all remember, Obama got criticized for his involvement in the Libyan conflict, got also criticized for his management of the Syrian conflict. How do you think these backlash will influence Biden's decision-making towards those two countries? Do you think his experience in the Obama administration will have an impact on his decision making? Will he be more apprehensive to maybe get involved? What are your thoughts on this question?
I think given the fact that many of his top foreign policy officials were former members of the Obama administration, I think their reticence about intervening fully within the region is going to play a role in their decision-making. However, you have to keep in mind that the economic interests of oil companies in Europe, as well as American oil companies in the middle of Eastern Syria, as well as in Libya, are going to play a role and an influence in the Biden administration. So I foresee the Biden administration doubling down on its support of our long-term allies within the region.
Thank you, Dr. Lenz. I'm going to move on to another main issue, a central issue for Middle Eastern politics and foreign policy in the Middle East, the relation with Iran. And so my question is for Dr. Parsi. President Biden, like President Trump, wants to renegotiate the nuclear deal with Iran. How his approach might differ from the previous administration? And also, do you think Washington can bring Iran back to the negotiation table, or is it basically just a staring contest between the two countries right now?
Thank you so much, and it's a great pleasure to be with all of you. You used the phrase, get Iran back to the negotiating table in your question. I think it's important to first clarify that the Iranians actually been at the negotiating table and have been in the nuclear deal and continue to be in the nuclear deal, and they've been so throughout this period. It was the United States under Trump that left the agreement tried to destroy the agreement. And the irony is that the JCPOA survived 4 years of Trump, but he may actually die within the first 6 months of the Biden administration, because Biden at the end of the day has pursued a strategy that is not particularly different from that of the Trump administration. Yes, they do want to renegotiate the deal, but they do want to do it inside of the deal, which is a significant difference from Trump. But the manner in which the Trump administration is pursuing, the Biden administration is pursuing this, then makes it far more similar to Trump than what it otherwise would be, because they're essentially insisting that the Iranians have to take the first step, and they're keeping the sanctions in place until Iran is in full compliance with the deal, because the Iranians have reduced some of their obligations. To the Iranians, this sounds as if the U.S. is just trying to make sure that Iran comes back into compliance without the U.S. lifting a single sanctions, which means that the U.S. completely stays out of the deal. And then at that point, we'll try to renegotiate the deal by using the sanctions of the Trump administration as leverage, which then makes Biden's approach very similar, if not identical, to that of Trump. And I think this is part of the reason why we have this deadlock. And my fear is now that as the Iranians are entering their presidential election, the opportunity to be able to revive the JCPOA is slipping out of our hands, because the Iranian perception increasingly is becoming that there actually is no Western option for Iran. The United States is not capable of sustaining an agreement with Iran because of its own political instability. The Iranians have now stabilized their economy. The IMF is saying that their economy is going to grow. So they feel that they have turned a corner on the sanctions, even with the US continuing the maximum pressure strategy. And as a result, why jeopardize that for something that, even if it were to work, who knows what the next president in 2024 would do? Donald Trump was impeached twice, but he's still the most important person in the GOP. He may make a comeback in 2024. So what is the sustainability, the reliability of an agreement with the United States? And that would be a huge change if then in a couple of months' time, we have an Iran that no longer is interested in the JCPOA. That would definitely pave the way for a crisis.
You think it's, I know you follow Iranian politics quite well. So far, what do you see from the Iranian election? Do you think there's a chance that they might pull back from the JCPOA, or is there still an incentive or willing right now from Iran to stay within, to stay at the negotiation table, as you said?
Well, the Iranians are staying, so at this point there seems to be that, but whether that changes after the elections remains to be seen. I suspect that even if they lose interest, they're going to nominally claim that they're still interested in the JCPOA in order to reduce or at least phase out the international blowback against the ship on their hand. But I think it's important to understand that after 4 years of Trump, a JCPOA that was destroyed, the promise that politicians can make in Iran, as Rouhani did in 2013, that, you know, I can resolve your problems by striking a deal with the West and lifting sanctions, that promise has few buyers today because of the experience of the Iranians, in which the deal was struck, the Iranians lived up to the deal, the IAEA reconfirmed that 14 times, yet the United States itself pulled out, and Iran is ironically, paradoxically, under more sanctions today when it's still in the JCPOA than it was when the JCPOA did not even exist.
Thank you for this enlightenment. We will now move to a more roundtable format. So my following questions are for all of you. So I might pick in order, but you're all welcome to answer. To stay maybe on the transition aspect, so what President Biden inherited from Trump, I think another central issue of the Trump presidency was the relation with Israel. As we all know, the Trump administration moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, recognized Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which is also an important move towards Syria, and facilitated the normalization of relations between Israel and multiple Arab countries. So we already know from various memos and the national security strategic document that was released recently that the Biden administration is still committed to Israel's security, but also wants to reset its relations with Palestine. So knowing that and knowing what they inherited from the Trump administrations, where does the Biden administration go from here on the Israel-Palestine issue and also regarding its relation with Israel? I don't know if someone wants to start. Maybe Dr. Gauz?
Sure. I think the short answer is nowhere. Doesn't go anywhere. It's not going to reverse the symbolic steps that the Trump administration took on the embassy and on Golan. I think we do have to recall that the one Middle Eastern state that continues to have broad support within the American political class across parties is Israel, despite the problematic elements that Mr. Netanyahu presents for any effort to get to a two-state solution. But I think that
you know, in the wake of the failures of American presidents from Clinton to Bush 43 to Obama to Trump to make any movement on Palestinian-Israeli issues, I doubt the Biden administration is going to make that a major element of its Middle East policy. I think we have to recall that this is now the third administration that's come into office, basically saying that it wants to de-emphasize the Middle East in terms of overall American foreign policy. And in that sense, I don't think it wants to create any problems. And delving into Arab-Israeli issues, delving into Israeli-Palestinian issues, just creates a lot of domestic blowback within Washington. I think that the Biden administration has its hands full with trying to, with its attempt to, and I take Trita's points that you know, one can argue with the tactics, but I think their desire is to get back to JCPOA and maybe some kind of JCPOA plus, but that's their first priority. Getting into an initiative on Palestinian issues is something that's only going to rile up members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, and just create more problems for an administration that has, you know, that faces a 50-50 Senate that counts on the vice president to get things through in the Senate. So I just can't see the Biden administration making a big initiative on Arab-Israeli stuff right now.
Thank you. Dr. Lenz?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up with what Dr. Gauz was saying, and specifically referring to the phrase reset. In foreign policy, the American administrations have been fond of this term reset. And I think reset is the wrong term. We saw what the Obama administration tried to do when it wanted to reset its relationship with Russia back in the first administration or the first term of the Obama administration. So I think in terms of the Arab-Israeli conflict, Dr. Gauz is absolutely right that the JCPOA is going to take priority. Dealing with the situations in Libya and in Syria are going to take priority. And it's going to be more of a waiting game to see that, you know, maybe this will be one of those legacy issues that the Biden administration will try and deal with in year four of its administration, you know, to try and leave a legacy in foreign policy, has been the want of many presidential administrations in dealing with the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Thank you. Dr. Parsi, did you want to add on?
Sure. I agree 100%. As Greg said, it's going nowhere. As Dr. Lenz is saying, this is not a priority. Only thing I would disagree with is it's not as if those other issues are priorities either. The JCPOA is not a priority. If it was, Biden would have moved fast as he promised to do, as all of his advisor argued that they would do before getting into office. What is the priority is exclusively domestic political issues right now. And this administration doesn't want to spend a single dime of domestic political capital on foreign policy issues. And the calculation is that even the risk of escalation is domestically less costly than the risk or the political capital they would have to spend in actually getting movement or, God forbid, a compromise on some of these issues. As a result, I wouldn't call any of these issues a priority, although I do agree with all of the panelists that if we were to rank some sort of a future priority list that the administration would have once it's passed its domestic agenda, which you know, arguably may never be the case, but nevertheless, in that scenario, yes, without a doubt, the Israeli-Palestinian issue is going to be at the very bottom of that list. And I think we have to remember one thing. Barack Obama grew up outside of the United States. He had an African father. He was brought up by a Muslim stepfather. He was not a product of Washington. As a result, his personal inhibitions to take on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, his personal inhibitions to end up in a direct confrontation with the Israeli prime minister were completely different and far less than that of someone like Joe Biden, who very much is a product of Washington, D.C. And as a result, almost having their DNA that, you know, one of the last things you want to do is to pick a fight with the Israelis or with the Saudis for that matter. I mean, the stark difference between what Biden said on Saudi Arabia during the campaign and what he's doing once in office should be quite instructive.
Thank you, Dr. Gross. I think you wanted to add something.
Yeah, Chita, help me on this. There's no need to go to Congress for the Biden administration to get back into JCPOA, right? And so the political capital issue is, it's more kind of symbolic than real in that you don't have to get 50 votes in the Senate for something. So they could move, the Biden people could move on Iran without having to expend that much capital, right?
I agree with you 100%. They don't agree with you. So let me explain what I think their perspective is on this issue. First of all, they do believe that there's going to be some political capital spent on this because Robert Menendez is one of the Democrats that was opposed to the deal, remains very much opposed to the deal, is the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chair, and has, in their view, and I think it's exaggerated, significant influence as to whether their nominees for cabinet positions will go through or not. And we see right now that Colin Kall's nomination is being jeopardized, and much of the attacks against him is precisely because he was such an effective advocate for the JCPOA. But then there is one element of the domestic political capital that I do agree with them on, which is that in 2023, the JCPOA's timeline is such that the Iranians are supposed to ratify the additional protocol and the United States is supposed to lift sanctions in Congress. What the JCPOA had done up until 2023 was that the president would waive sanctions every 120 days, every 180 days, depending on the sanctions bill. But by 2023, which means 8 years into the deal, enough trust and progress should have been completed, you know, had the US not pulled out, then they were gonna take permanent steps, not reversible steps. And the permanent step is that the Iranians make the additional protocol part of national legislation, and the US would actually lift sanctions in Congress. Now, the problem for the administration's perspective on this is the political capital it requires to lift sanctions in Congress is quite extensive, and it would happen a year before the 2024 elections. But raising that issue, however, raises another question. Well, if that's the case, does this administration actually want to go back into the deal at all? I think they do. But they want to have a very early promise, almost a precondition for coming back into the deal, that the Iranians are going to agree to change the timeline and push 2023 to 2025 or 26. I personally think that's actually quite reasonable. I think the manner they have approached it is counterproductive because it's only fueled the Iranian suspicions that there's a whole set of other things that the administration is going to try to do in renegotiating the deal by using Trump's sanctions. And they're not gonna be okay with that, because if they green light that, they think that they're just gonna get completely screwed over. And I think one thing we have to really keep in mind, this may be true in the minds of some people in the administration, that just because the United States has a new president, now it's suddenly trustworthy. That is not in the minds of anyone in Iran, and frankly, not in a whole lot of other countries either. The United States is still the United States. It has a reputational and trust issue that it needs to deal with. Just changing the president is not enough.
Thank you. I think I'm going to stay, trying to stay on the topic of Israel, but moving maybe towards another factor that might push Iran further away from a new deal or willingness to engage with the U.S. Trump facilitated the normalization of relations between some Gulf countries and Israel. First, do you all think that the Biden administration is going to build on that? So maybe try to negotiate normalization between other countries and Israel? And also then what is the impact on the relations with Iran? Is it a risk of isolating Iran further? And is this is this going to ruin any efforts to renew or reintegrate or negotiate a new JCPOA? I don't know, maybe if Dr. Parsi, you want to go first on that one?
Sorry, I think you broke up a little bit for me. Could you repeat that question?
Yes, I was talking about normalization of relations between some Gulf countries, other Arab countries in Israel that were broken by the Trump administration, and how that might push Iran back, and how that might affect the relation between the U.S. and Iran if the Biden administration continues to move forward with those normalizations.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And yes, the Biden administration is definitely moving forward with those. They're welcoming those without trying to praise the Trump administration. And I think this issue has, by and large, been presented as the formation of an anti-Iran camp in the Middle East. It's always existed there. I mean, the Israelis and the UAE have been collaborating for some time now. The Israelis and the Saudis have had a de facto alliance more or less for roughly 12 years, going all the way back to the war with Lebanon in 2006. This is now more formalizing it. But I think there's a bigger issue that has been missed. Yes, there's definitely an Iran dimension to this, but there's also a US dimension to this, an even more important US dimension to this. These three countries, UAE, Saudi, and Israel, strongly favor the United States retaining a very strong, if not hegemonic, military presence in the Middle East. They benefit from it tremendously, arguably the Saudis and the UAE much more so than the Israelis, because at the end of the day, Israel is a very powerful country with a very independent and formidable military that can survive quite well even without an American military presence in the region. The Saudis and the UAE are in a completely different position in which they do need that umbrella much more so. But all of them have benefited from it. All of them have expanded their maneuverability from it. All of them have favored from the fact that the U.S.'s military presence has tilted the balance of power in their favor in a manner that they could not achieve on their own, mindful of their more limited power. By creating this alliance, particularly mindful of the fact that this was, to at its core, you know, an arms deal in which the UAE is buying F-35s, is a way for them to actually bind the United States further to their security and make such an exit more difficult. When you buy these F-35s, what you're essentially buying is an implicit defense pact. The UAE and the Saudis don't have a formal defense pact with the United States, but the large purchases of arms spending functions as an implicit defense pact, because the United States develops an interest in making sure that countries that buy such advanced American weaponry do not lose wars. It would be embarrassing for the United States if they did. I think Yemen is an example in which the U.S. is deeply involved in that war as a result of its deep military ties to the Saudis. So I think in many ways, this was actually really aimed at making sure that the United States would not do what I think Greg mentioned, three presidents in a row have promised that they want to de-emphasize the Middle East, start to pull out, shift their focus eastward, shift their focus at home as well. And as a result, if that succeeds and the U.S. is kept there, that, I think, is one of those issues that is going to make it more difficult to find some sort of a modus vivendi with the Iranians. Because as long as the United States is very deeply militarily involved, the threat picture that the Iranians will see will still be a very stark one. And I think it's going to complicate all other issues. From an American perspective, I think the issue, though, is that an overwhelming, or let me put it this way, an increasing majority of Americans, and this is clear looking at all of the opinion polls as well as how politicians act during election campaigns, want to get out of the Middle East. And from a strategic perspective, I think a very clear argument can be made about that as well. But these arms deals and these configurations make that all the more difficult. Three presidents have tried, they have failed. They haven't failed because it was the wrong strategic choice. They failed because of inertia, and because of all of these entanglements of contracts and agreements, et cetera, that makes it more difficult for the United States to be a little bit more nimble strategically.
Thank you. Dr. Goss, did you want to add something maybe on if the Biden administration is going to pursue other normalization agreements?
My guess is no. There might be some low-hanging fruit in Oman, on this, but look, I agree with Trita in the sense that every one of these deals is really a deal with the United States. It's not really a deal between the Arab country and Israel. Morocco has had informal relations with Israel since the 60s. The preliminary talks that led to Sadat's trip to Jerusalem occurred in Morocco under the patronage of then King Hassan II. And the exaggeration of the importance of these deals in the United States during the election campaign was obvious. You know, I would, when people would say, oh, well, President Trump did a peace deal between Arabs and Israelis, I said, yes, he ended that horrible Emirati-Israeli war that had killed so many people. Now, these weren't peace deals. These were just recognition deals. And I think that they serve as evidence that one of the most prominent tropes in the Middle East itself, which is American decline and American departure, is actually wrong. Trita and I can disagree a bit about whether it would be good for America to depart from the Middle East, but the belief in the region that America is leaving is very strong. And yet, when Mr. Kushner went out and said, the US wants you, Emiratis, Bahrainis, to do a deal with Israel, what do? They do a deal with Israel. Now, the Emiratis and the Bahrainis were able to kill a couple of birds with this one stone, right? The Emiratis, who had very closely embraced the Trump administration and thus kind of blotted their copybook with many people on the Democratic side, were able, through the recognition of Israel, to not only please the Trump administration in case it got reelected, but also to show people in the Democratic Party that they're willing to have open relations with Israel, which is something many Democrats were quite supportive of. And so the UAE kind of, I think, took a smart short-term step here. But every Arab move toward Israel, whether it be Sadat in the 1970s to the Abraham Accords now, is really a move toward the United States, right? And you know, if the Omanis want something from Washington, maybe they'll do this. Trita is absolutely right that informal cooperation has been going on. I wouldn't call it an alliance because I just don't see military cooperation, which is what I would kind of say is necessary for an alliance. But yeah, there's been political cooperation on the basis of desire to confront or roll back Iranian influence. So there's really no geopolitical change from the Abraham Accords. Let me just say one more thing about Trita's larger point about American military presence, which I think really is, that's the core issue here. Two presidents came into office saying they wanted to reduce the American military presence in the Middle East. And the Obama administration did it somewhat, but there were still about 50,000 American troops in the greater Middle East when the Obama administration left office. And the Trump administration came in saying they wanted to stop the endless wars, right? President Trump called them the stupid wars. And when the Trump administration left office, there were about 50,000 American troops in the greater Middle East, right? The Biden administration comes in and says, withdraw from Afghanistan, maybe we have to rethink that. So you can understand kind of, given day-to-day politics in Afghanistan and all these places, the reluctance and the inertia that Trita talks about that I think has a lot to do with our military strategy and where we poured concrete. But I also, the place where I would, I think, disagree with Trita on this is, the consequences of a U.S. withdrawal, I think, could be more negative for American interests. And by that, I mean a complete withdrawal. Take up the bases and just leave. The whole reason the United States says it's in the Middle East, or at least in the Gulf region, is to protect the free flow of oil. And we've seen what I thought was a remarkable escalation in September of 2019.
with the attacks on Abqaiq and Khuraiz in Saudi Arabia. The Abqaiq gathering facility is the single most important oil node in the world, right? About 5% of the world's oil production goes through that node every day. It didn't have that much effect on prices because, you know, we're in a relatively supply-rich oil market. But I thought that that was a startling escalation. And American military presence was there, and the United States did nothing. And so I do think that a more strategic approach in the Middle East does have to think through what are these military forces there for if they're not there to deter and combat efforts to affect the free flow of oil. But that's a much larger question than we can get into.
It is a great question, though. Professor wants to go in first, go ahead.
I was going to say we're going to get into this big debate of the pivot maybe away from the Middle East in a few moments, but I want to give the chance to Dr. Lenz to respond to the question as well.
Thank you. Yeah, it was, I was in a way, I'm responding to what Greg was bringing up there about the oil. Just the oil and gas issue, you know, this economic motivation, kind of a world systems theory perspective, I think has a lot of influence. It is going to influence, you know, who the United States is supporting in Libya and the problems we've had in supporting the GNA in Tripoli in the case of Libya relative to Haftar in the east versus the Russians supporting Assad and us in supporting the Kurds in the northeast, given the fact that Conoco has been there in Syria wanting to secure the oil and gas derricks and in the creation of these pipelines. So I think the geopolitical aspect and the economic aspect of this helps to inform the strategic reasons why the American military still has a presence there. But I would agree with Greg that the whole trope has definitely been overhyped in the last few years. So it'll be interesting, I think, in the years ahead to see what happens. And we, of course, can talk about that later.
Well, since you've all started to talk about US involvement in the broader sense, in the military sense first, but in the broader sense in the region, and as you mentioned previously, both Obama and Trump have promised to retract from the Middle East to get fewer troops involved, and both were brought back to the regions for different reasons. The Syrian war certainly didn't help, but other issues as well. So considering all that has been tried in the last two administrations, but also considering President Biden's willingness to pivot towards Asia, which was what Obama promised but never achieved, do you think, and this is, I know, the big question for decision makers and experts, but do you think the U.S. will finally pivot away from the Middle East during this administration? And my follow-up questions is what are some potential issues that could derail this plan this time? What are some potential issues that you think could make this pivot fail once again? I don't know if someone wants to start.
Can I go first this time?
Yes, sure.
Well, first of all, I love this conversation because this is a conversation that I think at the end of the day will determine almost all the answers for all of the other questions. America's strategy and decision as to whether to be present there military or not, whether to dominate the region or not, will determine a whole set of different issues. And trying to do it the other way around doesn't get us very far. So I'm delighted to have this conversation and to have it with all of you. The question of oil, and as Greg mentioned, you know, that has been one of the key reasons why the military is there. But as Greg's example itself demonstrated, the military presence, which at that time was 58,000 troops, did not deter the attack that most likely was conducted by the Iranians against the Saudis. And Donald Trump did not act on the Carter Doctrine, which would have meant that he would have taken military action against it. I think while oil there still is important and it's still motivating oil companies, and it will always motivate oil companies, it is not what it used to be. In 2018, the same year when the United States actually became a net exporter of oil, only 15% of its oil was imported from the Persian Gulf. 40% of China's oil came from the Persian Gulf. 76% of all of Asia's oil is coming from the Persian Gulf. In essence, the United States is subsidized Chinese purchases of oil. And when you take a look at it from a larger picture, whether one is in favor of a tougher stance against China or not, nevertheless, this is highly relevant. The question then becomes, even though it is less important, it still is important. I would still say it is a core strategic interest of the United States to make sure that there is a free flow of oil and commerce in the Persian Gulf because of its importance to the global economy, which then affects the United States population itself. Is it necessary, however, to have a permanent military presence in order to be able to deter any such attacks or be able to deter any one country that would like to close off the Strait of Hormuz? The only country that has threatened to close off the Strait of Hormuz is Iran. And the only time they've even gotten close to trying is when they themselves could not sell their oil. Under all other circumstances, they have absolutely no interest whatsoever to do so because it's suicide for them as well. But only when the United States actually moved to completely eliminate Iran's oil sales did the Iranians start to move in the direction of making such threats. And then we saw the attack as well. We're coming out with a report, and hopefully in a couple of weeks' time, a military analysis that makes the case that while this is an important interest, it can completely be achieved without having that type of a permanent military presence. Now, understanding the political circumstances in Washington, D.C., we fully understand that there cannot be a reduction from 58,000 troops to zero overnight or even over a course of 5 or so years. But I think it's important to understand that it is not necessary to have it. Our interest actually doesn't justify this. We can still achieve those objectives without that type of a military presence. And mindful of the fact that the military presence has created all kinds of other challenges for the United States and for the region as a whole, we should start thinking about a longer term strategy of dramatically reducing troop levels. Will this administration do so? I would be quite surprised, because of a combination of two factors. One, if they're not willing to take on Prime Minister Netanyahu, MBS, and others on the Iran deal, rest assured they're not going to take them on when it comes to reducing military troop levels in the Middle East or in the Persian Gulf as a whole. This would definitely create tensions and would require a tremendous amount of political capital to be spent. So once again, we have an administration that will express this as a preference, but likely do very little about it at the end of the day. Secondly, even though they express it as a preference, I'm not convinced that the majority of them view it in the manner that I described it. They may want to reduce it a bit in order to be able to say that they've ended some endless wars, but not necessarily in order to fundamentally shift America's military presence.
Thank you. Dr. Lentz, do you want to answer?
Sure, absolutely. I would argue that we're going to see the continued buttressing of alliances. You know, that was part of the Biden campaign's campaign platform, was to re-engage with alliances like NATO and all of our historic alliances. So, you know, just as Trita was saying, that no one is going to, in the Biden administration, is going to truly stand up to an Israel. So I see what would likely happen is that there will be a semblance of American troops there for the foreseeable future. There's going to be a contingent there to have our presence there to maintain our hegemony of the region, you know, and to promote our interest in places like Libya and Syria, because that is going to help with the continued supply of oil. And we do not want that oil going anymore to a Russia or a China. We want to limit that amount. So I think the military troop presence will remain, but I don't see the Biden administration making any huge waves to try and withdraw American troops.
Thank you, Dr. Goss.
Yeah, this is, I'm with Trita on this, and that this is the big question, right? So let me talk a little bit about the big question and then a little bit on what I think the Biden administration's gonna do, right? So what kind of military presence is, I think, just as important as the total number. And there's two kinds that the US has right now, it seems to me. One is troops in conflict areas or areas that might be conflict areas, like Syria, like Afghanistan, and troops in Iraq to try to buttress the Iraqi government and act against a resurgence of ISIS. As a possibility, because you know that's why we were in Syria and that's why we were in Iraq, and I doubt very much that the Biden administration wants to pull out of those places, because the downside risk if you get an ISIS resurgence is politically pretty great, and you talk about events deflecting you from what you want to concentrate on, whether it's a pivot to Asia or domestic. And if you get ISIS doing what it did back in 2011, 2012, right? That's all over the papers. That's all over the TV. And you can tell how old I am when I say it's all over the papers, as if people actually read newspapers. And the other element of the presence is actually, I think, much more sustainable and much less controversial. And that's the presence in the smaller Gulf states, which have been host to foreign military presences for a century and a half. And those are, I think, much more sustainable than these deployments in conflict zones, which I think we have to be working to end. Now, the third kind of deployment would be in Saudi Arabia, which I think is creates more problems than it's worth. Going back to 9/11, I mean, it was the American military presence in Saudi Arabia that kind of galvanized Al Qaeda to attack the United States. And frankly, I don't think the Saudis need an American military presence. We can talk about that down the line. In the short term, I think the Biden administration wants to minimize problems in the Middle East. They don't want to have to be drawn into the Middle East, right? It's Michael Corleone from The Godfather 3. Just when I thought I was gonna get out, they drag me back in. And any movement like away from Afghanistan, away from Syria, Iraq, would run the downside risk of having something blow up that would draw the Biden administration back in. I actually think that they're probably going to keep American troop levels roughly where they are, because they don't want to have to deal with the Middle East. And they're afraid that if they withdraw and the government in Afghanistan collapses, for example, that then they have to pay a domestic price, or they have to get back involved. Just one more thing on this. Professor Lenz used the term U.S. hegemony in the region. I don't know, maybe this is too academic a point. I don't think the U.S. was ever hegemonic in the Middle East. If we were hegemonic in the Middle East, we would have had an Israeli-Palestinian deal, and we would have had an Israeli-Syrian deal at the end of the 1990s and in 2000. If we were hegemonic in the Middle East, we wouldn't have the problems we have with Iran, because Iran would feel the need to at least accommodate the United States. We had unipolar power. Nobody could challenge our power. But we didn't have the kind of acceptance in the region that real hegemony requires. I mean, the last real hegemon in the Middle East was Great Britain in the interwar period. And so I think, if people in the policy world think of us as hegemonic in the Middle East, it's a category error which can lead to real policy difficulties. That might be a little more academic than practical.
So if I summarize, most of you are skeptical about the military pivot, but open to maybe a diplomatic or attention at least pivot from the Middle East. I guess we'll see what is going to happen in the next few years. Thank you. This is what concludes our discussion. I had many more questions for you all, but I thank you for all your insightful answers and for accepting our invitation today. This was a really great discussion. We've covered a broad range of issues. And as we all know, Middle East and US foreign policy in the Middle East is not a simple issue, but I think we've been able to cover a vast amount of ground here. So thank you all, Dr. Goss, Dr. Lenz, and Dr. Parsi for your participation.
Je vous remercie d'avoir écouté ce balado de la chaire. Si vous voulez nous poser vos questions, vous pouvez le faire sur les médias sociaux de la chaire Raoul Dandurand, sur Facebook, Twitter et Instagram, en utilisant le mot-clic « balado de la chaire ». Je vous invite également à consulter notre site Internet si vous voulez rester à l'affût de nos activités au www.dandurand.ucam.ca. Et sur ce site Internet, vous pourrez aussi vous abonner à notre lettre d'info de la chaire. Et si vous êtes étudiant de deuxième ou de troisième cycle à l'université et que vous vous intéressez à la politique américaine, bien allez sur notre site au www.dandurand.ucam.ca. Vous y trouverez notre appel à communication pour notre colloque étudiant sur le thème « Les États-Unis sous la loupe de la relève en études américaines ». Vous avez jusqu'au 30 avril pour nous faire parvenir vos projets de recherche, vos idées de conférences et le colloque aura lieu le 26 mai 2021. Si votre candidature est retenue, vous pourrez présenter les résultats de vos recherches à l'occasion de ce colloque. On a très hâte de vous entendre. Et en terminant, si vous aimez le balado de la chaire, bien, n'hésitez pas à nous le dire sur votre plateforme d'écoute préférée. Et évidemment, un 5 étoiles est toujours extrêmement apprécié. Ce balado a été co-réalisé par Philippe-Julien Bougie et Clément Hamelin. Allez, à la semaine prochaine!